طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. Gaza is best described as the world's largest open-air prison. It is walled in by Israel, and the 2.2 million inhabitants cannot leave the confines of Gaza without being cleared through an Israeli checkpoint. It is clearly under siege. Over the years, it has often been bombed and raided by the Israeli military, and the Gaza people have nowhere to go to escape these assaults. These bombardments are often likened to shooting fish in a barrel. It leaves behind a massive traumatized population. Can you imagine the magnitude of the mental health crisis in Gaza? Here to talk about that is the Director General of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, Dr. Yasser Abu Jameh. He sat down for an exclusive interview with activist Nancy Murray, president of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation, to discuss the reality of serving as a psychiatrist to this massive traumatized population. The Gaza Mental Health Program is the leading Palestinian non-governmental organization which provides mental health services to the inhabitants of the Gaza Strip. The organization's stated purpose is committed to aid women, children, and victims of violence, torture, and human rights violations. Dr. Abu Jameh, thank you for taking the time to join us on This Week in Palestine to discuss the important work you do at the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. And thank you, Nancy, for joining us to share your work with the Gaza Mental Health Foundation and to help us navigate this conversation. Let's begin with you, Dr. Abu Jameh. Please tell us about the Gaza Community Mental Health Program and your work there, and the role the center plays under the siege of Gaza.
Thank you very much, Johnny. I'd like to begin by thanking you and Nancy and the audience for attending this program, and it's really a pleasure and honor to be there with you. The Gaza Community Mental Health Program is a non-profit, non-governmental organization that was established by the late Iyad al-Sarraj in 1990. And today, that's almost 33 years later, we still work, and our current mission and vision is to, our current vision is that GCMHP is a leading organization in the fields of mental health and human rights in Palestine. And our mission statement is that, guided by the principles of justice and human rights, Gaza Community Mental Health Program provides gender-sensitive, inclusive, integrated, and specialized community mental health services in Palestine. Our current strategic plan, we try to focus on three main objectives or three main goals. The first one is designed to respond to the increased needs for mental health services in Gaza Strip. And that includes the provision of preventive services, the provision of therapeutic services, and the provision of rehabilitation services. The second goal is to work on the capacity building, or building the capacities of people who work in the psychosocial sector. You know, over the years, the needs have never went down. They continue to grow up. And it was obvious to us that with the current number of professionals, which we have more than or about 100 people, including 70 technical people, we will not be able to respond to all the needs. And that's why we keep to work on investing in building the capacities of our sectors or our key actors that work in the field of mental health. That's why we have capacity building as our second strategic goal or second objective. That includes a contribution to training university students, for example, from the faculties of psychology, faculties of medicine. That includes also running a high diploma program in community mental health. The diploma program aims at the intakes are students who are graduates of psychology, sociology, mental health, and nursing. Together, they receive a two-year training program that aims at helping them, equipping them not only with the theoretical part, but also with the skills that are needed to work in the field of mental health. Now, the third strategic goal is concerned with to anchor human rights-based principles in the Palestinian community, and that includes our work on the reducing violence, you know, building the more human rights practices, you know, promoting community resilience. And that we do through engaging the community at large. That includes working with school teachers, that includes working with sport clubs, that includes working with kindergartens, that includes working with whoever is needed in order to promote community resilience, in order to help children, adolescents, and women difficulties, and also try to reduce any psychological impact that is caused by the current realities, including the work on reducing violence, including domestic violence. So these are our three strategic goals. We try to do that through a lot of work, either with the primary beneficiaries, let me say, the people who come to our community centers as patients, for example, or with their families. We are the only center that can provide across Gaza Strip through our three community mental health centers, comprehensive mental health care to children, women, and all kinds of people in the society. The care for children is very sensitive. Looking after women is also a very sensitive issue in our community, especially with the need to have high level of confidentiality and privacy. That is something that is ensured through our community centers. So in short, we try to offer some comprehensive services that are not limited only to therapy, but also to training programs and to trying to involve the community at large in our activities. Finally, we have a very nice program that aims at combating stigma and educating the whole society about issues that are related to mental health. So this is in brief what we do. Our services reached, I think, more than 20,000 people during the year 2022, including 4,400 patients.
Yeah, if I could say something about your work, it has come a huge way, a huge path of progress since it was started. I remember well when Dr. Iyad El-Sarraj was the only psychiatrist in the Gaza Strip when I first met him. And I remember when he decided he wanted to start the program. And in 1 year, 1990, he had managed to build a building and get it going. Can you say something about the history of the organization? What were the problems getting it off the ground? In addition, that was during the First Intifada, when there was so much ferment and a whole civil uprising of the entire society. What special problems did he face back then?
Well, at that moment, it was the 90s. I think his 1980s. And that was, at that moment, it was the beginning of the First Intifada. And then the only facility that was offering mental health services was the psychiatric hospital in Gaza City. And the psychiatric hospital is basically for inpatient, for severe cases or cases that need primarily hospitalization. And what he was seeing, what we all saw, is that during the First Intifada, there were a lot of things that happening that included, for example, raiding some of the houses, having a lot of confrontative issues between these, for example, the Israeli army and between the young people, you know, children in the streets. And in many cases, they were parents, I mean, were humiliated in front of their children. And that would cause some, of course, psychological impact. And people were coming to Yad's house, and he was sure that this is not the right moment, or that that's not the right way to refer them to come to the psychiatric hospital. They didn't need hospitalization by any means. So he started to think, what can we do in order to help the population and to work, alleviate the psychological impact of the current then First Intifada. And also there were many people who were taken into detention. Some of them were beaten up, some of them were tortured, some of them were like just put young kids for a few hours or for a few days and then sent back home. So that was a second problem that he was thinking about. And he was thinking together, which was really interesting, with Ruhama Martin, who was an Israeli human rights activist and psychiatrist. They were both, they shared the common interest, which is being psychiatrist and being human rights activist. She managed to establish Physicians for Human Rights Israel in 1988, while he continued a little bit further to think, what further can we do? And that's how it came to his mind, with a lot of friends from Sweden, to establish a community mental health center. And that was because he had two things in his mind. One is that the need to have a comprehensive mental health approach, you know, because you do not deal with patients. You deal with people. You deal with people who are victims of human rights violations, and many of them are not rich patients. They just are touched by the realities that they live under. And here we speak about especially children and women. And the other thing that he had is in his mind is how to help the ex-prisoners, you know, ex-detainees, how those people who were exposed to violence by the army or torture, how they can be of help. And that led to the idea that it's not a medical team. It should be a biopsychosocial team, you know. And he was applying what we call a biopsychosocial model. So his first team, I think they were like 7 to 9 people, included him and another physician, a psychologist, a social worker, and a nurse, and a couple of administrative people. So that was how it began. A very big, let me say, ambition, if I could say. But, well, he kept saying it many times, you know. He passed away in December 2013, leaving then more than 70 people working in the organization, having 3 community mental health centers, reaching out to those thousands of people. Today we speak about 100 people who work there. And we are really proud of the work that was achieved. And, you know, that was something that is beyond imagination, you know. I need to add to that that we are really grateful and thankful for all the people who are coming to Gaza, to GCMHP, who are looking at the developments that were taking care, that were happening there. They brought with them a lot of encouragement, you know, to Iyad and to his team, that allowed the opening of a second community center in 1992 in Khan Yunis, and the third one in Deir el-Balah in 1996. And a lot of those people were coming with expertise, you know. They were like advocates for justice, advocates for human rights. They were human rights activists. And also there were many professionals who were like psychiatrists, psychotherapists, who would come to Gaza to train the people out there. So the beginning was very, how to say, challenging. It was not easy, but it went very well. And yeah, the needs continue to be the, how to say, the drive of all the work that we are doing.
No, I appreciate your laying out the lay of the land that way, because I remember well, step by step, how it would expand. And Iyad would come to the United States. He was in Boston, I believe it was 1997, and he was given the first ever human rights award by the US-based Physicians for Human Rights. So he made a mark by combining mental health and human rights, always pointing out the human rights issues. And Ruchama Martan from the Israeli Physicians for Human Rights continues to be very outspoken. She's someone I just saw in May this year. She's an old friend going way back, feeling very frustrated about the direction her society is headed, I must say. So if Iyad were alive today, he would be dealing with what you're dealing with, which is a situation which has gotten so much worse. When you talk about people able to go and visit, I mean, now it is so difficult to get into Gaza with the blockade that has lasted nearly 16 years, which has really cut off the Gaza Strip from the wider world. He was an internationalist. He would, you know, had friends all around the world who he would invite, as you said, and they would be able to travel there. Say something about what it is like working under the conditions of siege and how much more difficult that makes the kind of work that you do.
Well, this is actually a very important issue. You know, sometimes people feel in Gaza like, you know, abandoned, you know, because again, the blockade caused a lot of problems. And this is something that was brought, by the way, to the international community in a similar manner during the COVID-19 and the social distancing issue, you know, when people were having difficulties traveling from place to place. And let me say, and seeing their beloved ones, or just basically going to work or going on for a conference or going to visit friends. And that is something that in Gaza continued not for 2 or 3 years, but now continued for 15 years and more than that. Actually, it even people started to feel the difficulty of getting into Gaza, not since the blockade started in 2007, but also prior to that. With the second intifada, there were more restrictions on people getting in and leaving out of Gaza. And the other important issue is that, you know, when the international community decided that one of its universal goals that were set, or values that were set for the 2030 Agenda for Sustainable Development, and to put its sustainable development goals, they were saying that one of the key and principal values was to leave no one behind, you know. When in Gaza Strip, I'm not sure if that applies, and if the international community is interested in leaving no one behind, then the blockade should be ended, or should be challenged. We used to face a big problem in just traveling out of Gaza and in Gaza. The WHO writes monthly reports about how many even patients who need to receive treatment in hospitals in West Bank or in East Jerusalem, in Palestinian hospitals, and they are denied the permit. So in one hand, it's affecting the intellectual people, you know, just interested in going to Gaza, but or people who work and need to go out for further studies. But on the other hand, it affects the whole population. And this blockade also affected the economy. It put great pressure on the economy in Gaza Strip. And for us as workers in the mental health field, we have to deal with the implications of those things, you know, whether when it affects the population at large, whether it affects the patients who need to be referred outside, or whether it affects the people who should be, you know, having some businesses outside, et cetera, et cetera. So the blockade is, by all means, it's against the human rights. It's written and let me say, described by many international human rights organizations as a collective punishment. And that is something that is really interesting. Why would the international community accept this form of collective punishment to Palestinian people? We speak about 2.3 million people in Gaza Strip. Half of them live under poverty level. Half of them are unemployed. We speak about, I think, 47%, the very recent unemployment rate in Gaza Strip. So imagine, you know, and it's a tiny geographical area. The population density is about 13,000 people per square mile. Imagine that, you know. And despite this poor economic conditions, we still continue to be under the blockade, which is again, sorry to keep saying it, but it's again against the human rights, you know, principles. So why it continues to be that, and lifting the blockade is one of the very simple steps that that should be made if the international community is committed to what they say in their strategic development goals to leave no one behind. You are leaving a whole society behind, not some marginalized people.
Yeah, and I believe half of the population are children.
Well, 48% of the population in Gaza Strip are children, which is more than 1,100,000 children. Imagine and, that among those half live under in families under poverty rate. That's more than 500,000 children, you know. Mm-hmm. And living under poverty rate is not that easy because, you know, and we have other problems like problem with power supply. Electricity is most, I mean, when it's at its best presence, it's like 8 hours on and 8 hours off. And when it's too cold or there is more consumption of power, then it's like 6 hours rather than 8, 6 hours on and 10 hours off. So imagine when you have a child who would need his clothes ironed or washed, or imagine if there is a need for like to get some heat for the place, or just imagine the need for two sets of clothing for the schools because they need to go to school 6 days a week, you know. So, I mean, those difficulties are affecting people at many different levels. And the children face a lot of difficulties. Just sometimes you can see it with your eyes. I mean, going to work, you can see children in the street. Most of them are well-dressed. We try to keep our children well-dressed. But when you look at things how they are, you know, you are sure that you see by your eyes, for example, they are not really wearing the right shoes for the winter. For example, they do not have the needed clothes for the winter. They look nice, but again, you feel that they are really feeling the cold and that there is not enough clothing for them. So, but that's how things are when things are difficult, when the unemployment rate is not improving, when poverty is not improving, the rate now continues to be there for about the last 5 or 6 years. The deterioration in economic conditions heavily really impacted the population. Sarah Roy writes well about what she calls systematic de-development that happens in Palestine. You know, this is for the last few decades. Showing that with time, the economy in that area is getting worse and worse over time. And she says that this is something that is intentional. It's a systematic thing. Well, when you deprive people of their main capacities, even to travel abroad or even to import whatever they want or to export, you know, your products, then what can you expect? Of course, we Palestinians, we don't have any control over any resources that we have, you know, and that's another a very unfortunate story.
Yes, and I believe even fishermen, when they're going about their daily lives, very close to shore, because Israel will not allow them to go to the nautical miles it agreed to in the Oslo Accords, they're fired on routinely by naval boats, and farmers who try to access the best, most fertile land in Gaza, which Israel claims is part of a seam zone, as Israel declared seam zone, because it's too near the wall, they get fired on. So even earning daily bread in these everyday type activities of farming and fishing can be lethal in the Gaza.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And these are the very simple ways of showing it. You know, with each large scale operation that happened in Gaza since 2008, for example, the first one, destruction happens to factories. The destruction happens to infrastructure. So while there is a steady decline over time, because at the economic level, because we don't have the resources to at least recover what we have lost. But there is acute decline that happens during the attacks, you know, the large scale military operations, because a lot of factories are destroyed, a lot of the infrastructure is destroyed. And there is no that there, there isn't that much capacity to rebuild what was destroyed. While many of the houses were rebuilt, for example, from 2008 or 2014, when we now speak about 2021, the May attacks, a lot of the houses were not rebuilt yet. I speak of like residences where people live in. And this continued to be the case. And with each, a factory that is destroyed or partially destroyed or it stops, you know, a lot of houses or a lot of families will end up not having resources because the breadwinner is not working anymore. And that is also adds to the poverty and increases the unemployment.
Yes. I don't know if most American audiences know that Israel closely monitors everything that enters the Gaza Strip, and they have a list of some, I believe it was 4,000 items, which are on a so-called dual use list and can't be permitted in without special scrutiny, which includes a lot of the material necessary to rebuild, say, water pipes after the bombings. And so, you know, that impedes any effort to get back to so-called normal, what passes for normal in the Gaza Strip after these repeated military onslaughts. Would you say something about how children especially are coping with the terror of from the skies, which Israel regularly inflicts on the Gaza Strip?
Well, We all the time look, there are things like, you know, or if I could say it's what we are going through is very unique, if I could say, to begin with in Gaza Strip, which is, you know, usually people in any society, they would grow up in a normal life, children feeling safe, you know, happy with their parents, you know, they go to schools, blah, blah, blah. And then a traumatic event might happen, you know, that could be an earthquake, that could be a tornado, that could be a car accident. But after the traumatic event, help and aid will come in. That could be in forms of like governmental aid, in forms of housing, in forms of support, moving to another place until things are there. The provision of psychological support through, skilled people. And people will just come back to their regular life, you know. And they will be able to deal with the losses, you know, and they will come back to their, if I could say, certainty, you know, their ways to develop, to plan, to work, and to go on with their lives. In Gaza, the conditions are not like that at all. You know. First of all, any child who is now, for example, 14 or 15 years old, who would have already passed through at least three large-scale operations, three military attacks. Now, what happens during the military attacks is that there is usually a continuous bombardment that continue for like at least 8 days, like in 2012, or as long as 51 days, like in 2014. Now, this is a continuous field of imminent death. 75 to 65% of the people who got killed or wounded during all those attacks, as shown by international human rights organizations, were just civilians. You know, they were doing nothing. They were just sitting at home or just walking in the street. So the sense of imminent death, the sense that there is no difference by life and death, and that you can sleep today and never wake up. You know, that caused a lot of things to happen within the structures, the family structures in Gaza Strip. And people dealt with it in different manners and very strange different manners. You know, I mean, the differences are, so I can give you a couple of examples. One example is that, you know, you see some families, they decided to sleep all in the same room, in the same space. And their idea is that if the place is bombed, then we all die together and then we all move together to the other life, for example. While other people thought of it in a very different manner. So they would scatter themselves in different places just to ensure that some of them will continue to live if something, you know, wrong will happen. Now we speak about how very simple, regular people think when the attacks are taking place because they have reached a conclusion that anyone can die at any moment, you know, and we cannot blame them. If you look at the number of people who got killed as families, you know, whole families for no clear reason, whole neighborhoods that were bombed for no clear reason, then you would understand how people think, you know. 28 members of my extended family passed away in one attack in 2014. You know, that included five families that were completely erased from the records. You know, it included three pregnant women. It included 19 children. They all were just gone within seconds, you know. So, and that is not only to my family. Many other families have gone through that. So when you think of children, you know, children are aware of what happens around them. They understand the fear, but they cannot react to it, you know. Cannot react to it. Because we, even adults, we don't have anything in hand that we can offer protection to our children or our kids. Yeah, we don't have really shelters. We don't have safe places. There are no safe place. And thus, when the extreme fear continues, makes children extremely alert and makes adults extremely neurologically, if I could say, exhausted. And it brings a lot of feeling of helplessness because there is nothing that you can do in your hand. So when things are over, we notice that there are like three kinds of symptoms that are presented. And sorry for that long introduction that I'm getting back to your question. In children, we see three kinds of responses. The responses during the attacks, which is could be extreme fear, you know, problems with sleeping, they cannot sleep at all, or various somatic pains, you know, pains in the knees, pains in the ankles, pains in the abdomen, you know, that is very frequent, you know. And then the very first few weeks after the attack, usually those pains continue. They might have even poor appetite. We have seen some children who stopped eating and they went underweight, and other children will still have problems with sleep. But a lot of children might develop also bedwetting. Bedwetting is rather common that we see in children after the large scale operations. And on the long term, actually, it might have clear PTSD, like full symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, or they might have just subtle, you know, deterioration in their capacity to, concentrate and to keep their studies record as good as they used to be. And that needs a lot of family education and community education to make people understand that the deterioration in the academic achievement of that child could be attributed to a traumatic event, especially when you look at when that began, when that started. Now, the other challenging factor, you know, as time goes or passes by, is that we are not, again, as I said, back to the normal, safe level in life. Why? Because you still, you are not transferred to any other place. You still see the destroyed areas around you. Reconstruction doesn't usually begin. At least it takes 1 year for that reconstruction mechanism to start. And finally, it's never post, because you have all the time what we call cues, things that remind the population of the traumatic event. One of those cues is the drones that keeps, you know, buzzing in the skies, you know, 24/7. And in the evening, the sound becomes louder and louder. And imagine in the middle of the night, it's absolute silence. And you just hear the sound, the high sound of the drones. What would you think of, you know? What would that child be thinking of at that time? Of course, it will bring him some bad memories. Save the children, and I'll end up with this made a report that was issued in July 2022. And they were talking about how the mental health of children were impacted, you know. And the children said they came with, you know, with alarming, really, figures. We knew that things are not good for the children, but the figures were really staggering. They said that children are feeling less safe away from their parents, 90% of the children, you know. And these children are not like 4 or 5 years old. We speak about children who are 11 or 12 years old. The figure is 90% in 2022. However, it was 60% in 2018. It increased, you know. Emotional distress among children, 8 out of 10 children is experiencing emotional distress. When it comes to caregivers, about 63% of caregivers feel that they are not useful, 61% unable to overcome difficulties. And that is for a simple reason. Again, maybe it's the feeling of helplessness that we have as parents during the attacks, but also when you have in mind that half of the population are poor under poverty line, half of the population have unemployment, then of course parents will feel that they are not useful to their children. So this is in...
Living under the drones and the bombs is one thing, which is just horrendous. I mean, we hear always that Israel, they have the sirens and everyone goes into bomb shelters if they think there's an attack. But in the Gaza Strip, which is basically, 23 miles long and 4 to 5 miles wide, it's a sandbar. I mean, you just don't have the capacity to escape from American-made, very modern armaments that are used on a regular basis with our tax dollars. There's also, though, another kind of attack on the people of the Gaza Strip, which is when they are expressing themselves in a civil uprising, as they did during the Great March of Return, when you had entire families gathering to basically demand the right to go home, demand an end to the blockade. And would you talk about how Israel responded to that and what that meant for your work?
Well, we all the time say that, the it's like a pressure cooker, you know. We have seen how the deterioration in economic conditions and the continuous attacks every now and then affected the population in Gaza Strip. And we could speak of three things. You know, the first one is the number of people of our clients. The number increased over time. We had the highest number of patients coming out to our three community centers in 2015. And we easily related that to the 2014 massive attacks on Gaza Strip that caused the displacement of than 500,000 people at that time, and leaving 100,000 people without a place to return to when the attacks were over, because their houses were basically, residences were destroyed. And then number decreased a little bit with time, but not that much decrease. It went back up again during the Great March of Return demonstrations. And then we got the highest last year after the May 21 attacks and then August 22 attacks. So one is we have noticed the increase in the number of people who come to our community centers, especially in the years that follow the larger scale operations. The second thing is that, people come with more difficult symptoms over time, So the symptoms are more severe, and that causes a more difficult, the need for more comprehensive intervention. So while sometimes it used to be enough to have just psychotherapy, now in most of the cases we combine psychotherapy, we add medication, like anxiolytics or antidepressants. And that caused an increase in the budget that we spent on medication. Last year, we bought medication for about $200,000, and that went free of charge to the patients because they cannot afford to pay it, to pay the cost. And then the third thing that we noticed is with the continuous deterioration in the socioeconomic conditions, recovery is becoming more and more difficult, it's difficult for us to help people recover from their conditions, especially when they come with depression. That is mainly caused by the lower and deteriorating socioeconomic conditions. And four, relapse happens. Relapse happens because the area is attacked. In the last couple of weeks, there were two nights when Gaza Strip was bombed, over one night and then over another night. Now, those bombs do not count, people do not count them, because they do not attract a lot of attention in the media. It's not continuous. But people in Gaza Strip, that is a strong reminder of what happened, and it causes relapse to a lot of population.
What is it about Gaza that it's treated so differently? Not that the West Bank is the promised land, but why the siege of Gaza? other than the fact that Hamas seems to have control. But is that the reason, or what beyond that sort of makes Gaza so unique that Israel really sets up this kind of blockade, this kind of siege?
Well, as you said, John, the main reason that the siege or the blockade began is when Hamas took power, you know, in 2007. Yeah. That's the claim. They wanted to undermine the power of Hamas or help the people get rid of Hamas or whatever is. But the Hamas issue is central to the plan. I am not a politician. I am not a military person at all. But they can't figure out how they thought that the blockade will do a thing, you know, like that. But the bottom line is that now we are 17 years or 16 years after that day. Mm-hmm. What happened? Did it succeed? I mean, it didn't succeed, you know. And what I see it is nothing more than another sort of collective punishment, you know, on people. Because, you know, when Hamas people want to go outside Gaza Strip, they can go outside Gaza Strip, you know. I mean, they need to coordinate. They are given the permit and they leave. So what is the reason behind that? And when it comes to conditions, you know, when you speak about the unemployment rate, of course, this is the whole population. When you speak about 53% unemployment rate, people below the age of 30, 60% unemployed, women below the age of 30, 70% unemployed. This is the general population. When we speak about 8 out of 10 children has have emotional distress, don't tell me that this is about Hamas. You know, this is just collective punishment, you know.
If I could just add that it's been a very useful, using Hamas as the, you know, boogeyman, has been a very useful way of splitting the Palestinian national movement. And it's also been very useful to have the Gaza Strip to try out American weapons. You know, it's almost functioned as a lab during these wars to try out new ways of forcing people to submit, which haven't to date worked. But I think one of the key reasons, and you can correct me if you have a different view, Yasser, is that some 70% of the people in Gaza are refugees. And they can see, just looking beyond the northern fence, where they came from. And it's almost like, you know, this is why the first uprising started in the Gaza Strip. You know, there's a real sense of injustice based on the fact that these are people who have been driven from their original homes and their descendants. Would you agree with that?
Well, yeah, because look, I mean, the Hamas came as a result of elections, general elections that took place in 2006. And I don't think that it's mainly Gaza Strip who elected Hamas. No, if you look at the figures, you will see how the results were. And I think people were just, they were going because they wanted, the intention was to punish the PA or to punish Fatah, because there were a lot of thoughts about how they managed the some sense of corruption or something like that. But the other very important issue is that what really occurred to me is that those elections took place in 2006. The main impact of the blockade, I think it maintained the division between the Palestinians in West Bank and in Gaza, because since 2006 until now, you know, we had to have at least how many? 4 cycles of elections. That is in 2010, 2014, 18, 22. I mean, we could have 4 possibilities to re-elect or to elect another people just in a democratic manner, you know, in a democratic way. We were one way or the other banned from doing that, you know, because we are divided. And we are divided because that division, I feel, that it's meant to be there and to continue to be there. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not only a collective punishment, but it also blocked us from our democratic means of just practicing our like rights, which is to go to the voting box and to decide what we want, you know. That is something that we were not allowed to do so far, you know, because of the division. And there are many players in the international community who are not allowing the reunion of the Palestinian people, you know, to have another some kind of elections. You know, we don't have until the moment a statement that the international community is going to accept the results of for example, of elections, like whoever wins will be like, you know, whether it's the PA or Fatah or Hamas or whoever, you know, because you need to accept the vote and what comes out of the vote, and then see, let the people see how that vote have, I mean, impacted their life, you know, and then they will decide again. In 4 years, they should decide again. It happens everywhere. It happens in the States, for example. People elect sometimes the Democrats, sometimes they elect the Republicans. It's your right. No one can come from outside and say, okay, elect this one, but not that one. This one is clever, that one is not clever. And on the other hand, you know, look at the Israeli side. In the last 3 years, they had more than five elections, if I recall. I mean, isn't that crazy? We couldn't have elections in 17 years, not for a single time. And Israel had five rounds of elections in the last 3 years. I mean, come on, guys. What is this?
So you're speaking to an American audience. You're here in Boston, and I'm very happy that you're with us, knowing how difficult it is to get out of Gaza. What would you say to Americans if they're going to raise their voice about a single issue to do with the Gaza Strip? What would it be?
That you need, you are a very civilized people. You know exactly how the things are, and we are not asking for more than justice, you know. Help us throughout the way to find justice, you know. Whatever justice means, I think any Palestinian person would accept whatever justice means, you know. And that's it. The very basic thing is to respect the human rights. The very basic thing is to lift the inhuman blockade on Gaza Strip, to end the collective punishment, to enable us, not only to enable us, but to push us towards having more and more elections, to reinforce and enforce democracy in the Palestinian people. Jimmy Carter was the one of the people who observed the first elections in 1996, if I remember well the date, in Gaza Strip and in the West Bank and the Palestinian areas, you know. We need those things. We do not need the blockades. We do not need, you know, attacks. We do not need, you know, fire jets that are bombing our houses every now and then. We just want freedom. We want our independence. We want our justice. We want our human rights respected. And I think the American people can go to their representatives and ask them just to push towards that that issue.
Yeah, I think there's a growing movement in this country to demand that the aid we give Israel, which sustains it and allows it to carry out the bombings of Gaza, it allows it to keep the Palestinian people under this military occupation. There's a growing demand to say you must condition aid to Israel on its human rights record. And in my view, that would mean they'd be cutting it off altogether, since the human rights record is so very, very dismal. If I could say also to the listeners, you can support Dr. Yasser's work through the organization of which I am president. We started it 2 decades ago. Well, we started it in actually 2001. It's called the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. It's based in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And we, our mission statement is to raise funds for the work being done on mental health issues in the Gaza Strip. So you could look at our website is gazamentalhealth.org. You could donate through the website or see where to send a check. And I hope you will, because as you've heard today, the work that needs to be done is just accelerating as the situation gets ever worse as the years go by. So I hope people will, you know, listen and then give generously to the work being done by Dr. Yasser Abu-Jameh and his colleagues. I'd like to thank John Roberts for this opportunity to be on This Week in Palestine, and I'd like to thank Yasser Abu-Jameh, for sharing with us these stories, which are really heartrending, about life there. And I urge everyone to make those demands of their elected representatives. Let's not just be indifferent. Let's not just stand by silently while the people of the Gaza Strip are put under this inhuman collective punishment. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, thank you. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Yasser. It is quite a story. I was able to go to Gaza in 2001 with Nancy, and we visited center at that point. It was much easier to get into Gaza in those days than it is now, because the last time we tried to go in, we were successful. So this is, to bring the story to the people of the United States is incredibly important, and I hope we're able to impact our government somehow, although it's been pretty discouraging up until now, but we can't stop. So thank you very much, and wish you much luck on your recent tour of the United States, and we'll keep watching the work that you do and supporting it in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And that concludes our discussion with Dr. Yasser Abu-Jameh, Director General of the Gaza Community Mental Health Program, and Nancy Murray, President of the Gaza Mental Health Foundation. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here every week at the same time and place. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. To access our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.